Words appear. The Battle of White Plains Theater Company presents. Alongside a Treble Clef, a film by Susan Bettman. Alongside a Bass Clef, in collaboration with Jeff Farber. A quotation appears. During my long musical career, I have met few really great artists, and I am pleased to name Michael Arnowitt, pianist and musician, as one of them. Louis Moyes. Michael Arnowitt, wearing glasses, dressed in a suit and tie, performs on a stage. Words appear. Beyond Idiot Keys. The music of Michael Arnowitt. In a montage, Michael bowing to an audience, sitting in a living room talking to a group of people, crossing a street, walking with a white cane. Words appear. Bach, Partita No. 1, Courant. Making photocopies. Discussing a music score with a colleague, and another. Taking a piece of music off the piano's music stand. Outdoors, playing an electronic keyboard with bass and percussion. Riding in a car. Playing on a concert stage. Talking to a group of people at a public event. Hugging a woman who is holding a paper plate. Examining a portrait of himself. Wheeling a suitcase at a train station. On a train. Carrying the suitcase while walking along a river. Continuing to walk towards an ornate building. Conferring with a piano technician who removes the entire keyboard and action from the piano. Michael playing on a stage in a room with multiple chandeliers. Talking with a couple of people at a restaurant, discussing CDs, having dinner with a colleague, on a train, a piano tuner at work, Michael shakes hands with the piano tuner.
I remember when I gave my concert here about a month ago, there was one note I was hoping
for. Yeah, but a revoice. Yeah.
And I would like to have you show me that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let's see if I can remember. I think it was an A.
Okay. Maybe when you play it, you will.
That A there, yeah.
Michael sits on the piano bench.
Any way to make that closer to its neighbors, tonally?
Let's do that.
Now the technician sits on the bench, pulls out the keyboard, examines one of the hammers.
I'm shaping the hammer, smoothing it up, making it so that it has a nice, fresh surface to strike the strings. Should notice. Significant difference now.
Pushes the keyboard back in place.
Let's try that.
Okay.
Michael sits on the bench.
See if I notice a difference.
Want to exaggerate just a little more?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
The technician back at work.
Sometimes we can feel a little bit of hardness in a certain part of the hammer.
The lacquer hardened up over time.
Mozart, Sonata number 15. Allegro. Countryside.
Second week in May is a special time in Vermont because you get all these different shades of green. It's truly beautiful. I enjoy that part of the year the most, and that's when I first came to Vermont.
Bicycling along a country road. Crossing a bridge over a river. Eric Satie, Pièce Froide, number 2. The river courses around large boulders. The bicycle carries panniers in the back. In the distance, the profile of Camel's Hump Mountain. A rock face on the left side of the road. Forests and mountains. Now bicycling on a dirt road. Down a hill towards a town. Reaching the Vermont State House, a Greek Revival building with a gold dome topped with a Roman statue. On the sidewalk. Sandy Morningstar, friend and poet.
I first met Michael with a violin in his hand. He had answered an ad for backup musicians for my friend Normal, who was a poet. Since Normal and I had a pretty good working relationship as friends and fellow poets, I got to know Michael as part of Normal's background music.
Michael's wife, Susan.
Michael and I met because we were both involved in the Peace Center, which was a group that used to do coffee houses and peace-related political activities. Well, this was in 1984, thereabouts. So primarily we're working on Central American issues. And among other things, they sang at the camp at the coffee house that was associated with that. So that's where we met.
Sandy Morningstar.
Norman and I went to a party at Michael's house on Liberty Street. And it was a fun party. I can remember being in the front room of his house with a collection of assorted musicians and poets and neighbors banging on pots and pans and doing a drumming session. And we had wooden spoons and we had lids and we were just knocking about, having a great rhythm session. And all of a sudden, in the other room, there is the sound of this incredible piano music. And I grew up with good classical music. My ear can tell me if someone's just fooling with the piano or if someone has some real talent. And within moments, everyone had dropped pots, pans, lids, spoons, and had drifted into the back room to see who was playing the piano, because this was obviously not a recording.
Susan.
When I met Michael, he wasn't playing. And I remember one of his friends came to visit, a woman who was living in Chicago, and we were out traipsing around in the country, and she said, "Oh, and Michael's a really great pianist." And I said, "What?"
Susan making dumplings.
He's a what? I mean, I knew he played guitar, and he played guitar very well, and he played fiddle. But I had no clue that he played piano.
Sandy.
Michael was playing fiddle behind Normal and printing a newsletter called Peace Soup. And Peace Soup was a combination environmental, politically left piece of information that he hand-printed and hand-distributed and essentially put out into the community. And to finance this, Michael was recycling, collecting cans and bottles and newspapers, really working hard to try to raise money to print Peace Soup. At one point, I said, "If you want to raise money for Peace Soup, give a concert, and I will round up everybody I know, and we will pay to hear you play."
Susan.
That fall, he decided to do a benefit for the same Peace Center that I mentioned earlier, and went and played for me on some friends' really rickety upright piano. And he played the Brahms Ballade, which is one of both of our favorite pieces of music. And it was just stunning. I mean, he really was a pianist.
Sandy.
It felt so good to know that Michael was trusting us with his gift. Because that's exactly what it was. He was really trusting us with his gift.
In concert. Bach, Partita number 1, Preludium. Thank you.
I was born in Boston, and my family eventually settled in Lexington. It's a historic town, a lot of American Revolutionary history there, and we studied American history in third grade, and we studied American history in fourth grade, and American history in fifth grade, and sixth grade, and seventh grade, and eighth grade, and ninth grade, and in 10th grade, we studied world history. In 11th grade, all students in Massachusetts were required to study American history again. I have one younger brother. There have been occasions where we haven't spoken about, say, music to each other for a while, and then we will discover that we have both grown an interest in one particular type of music simultaneously. My father is quite a music lover, and he impressed upon me love for certain composers that he particularly liked. He's a physicist, and my mom also has an advanced college degree in physics. That's how they met. My mom was actually born in Seoul, Korea, and came over here in the 1950s. She had gotten together some money from her neighborhood in Seoul, you know, go to America, get this nice fancy education, come back to Korea. But since she met my father and married, ended up staying here. She grew up under Japanese occupation, but doesn't seem to have any prejudice whatsoever against the Japanese, which I think is quite admirable. She knows four languages, which I only know one, and I've made several attempts at foreign languages, but I realized the other day that I really do know one foreign language quite well, and that's music. Because music has a syntax, has a grammar, has a vocabulary, has slang. I remember some of my first piano books, and my mom shepherded me along. They enrolled me in the pre-college division of the New England Conservatory of Music. My first piano teacher was a fellow named Angel Ramon Rivera. I owe most of my musicianship to him.
Rivera.
And there's a lady who was the head of the preparatory school, and she was the founder of the preparatory school, called Frances Lanier. And Mrs. Arnowitz, Young In, kept calling her about having an interview for her son. And Mrs. Lanier said, we don't take children so young. We wait until they're seven. But Young In was persistent. And she, her argument was, he wants music now. What am I going to do until he's seven?
He had an opening at 2 o'clock on the day that my parents were trying to get me in. He didn't seem to care whether I was 4 years out or 5 years out.
And that first day we had our first lesson. And it was a magical lesson. I think we went almost through the first book on one lesson. I just told him a few things and we were able to read right through the book. The Arnowitz, who were perfect piano parents, they were there. Their presence was always there. They gave him every opportunity, but they never told me what I should do with Michael. I think they really knew that Michael was extraordinary. And so to allow me the privilege and the opportunity to work with him, that was really very trusting of them. I'm very grateful to them.
Michael studied with Mr. Rivera until his sophomore year in high school. During that time, Michael won a number of significant prizes and awards. At age 14, he made his debut in a recital in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
The program introduces Michael Arnowitz, Niño Pianista.
He performed twice as a soloist with the Boston Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Mr. Harry Ellis Dixon. During Michael's last 2 years of high school, each weekend his parents accompanied him to New York so he could continue piano and composition studies at the Juilliard School. At 17, Michael received the BMI Award for Young Composers. This prestigious award had been given to some of America's most outstanding composers, including George Crumb, Philip Glass, and John Harbison. In 1980, Michael was among the first recipients of the Presidential Scholars Award, created by then-President Jimmy Carter. The citation was awarded for outstanding achievement in academics and the arts. It was after high school, before entering Yale University, that Michael's parents told him that the eye condition he had dealt with since childhood had no cure, and his vision would continue to deteriorate throughout his life. Despite this news, Michael continued to pursue his musical studies. His musicianship impressed his fellow students, and they were surprised when he abruptly left school and changed the course of his career.
Scott Speck, conductor.
I was in a composition class, and every student in the class had to write a small piece of music that was going to be performed at a little recital at the end of the year. And our assignment, in addition to writing the piece, was to recruit the people who were going to play in it. And I had heard Michael play, and I just thought he was fantastic, and asked if he would play for this small piece I was writing. About a week or so before the performance, maybe 2 weeks, Michael called me and regretfully informed me that he wouldn't be able to play in this recital because he was dropping out of school. The reason that he was leaving was it was not simple, but it had a lot to do with the fact that he felt there were a lot of false expectations being placed on people in that kind of context, and that people, many of them, as I remember, seemed to be so concentrated on getting good grades and not concentrated on the things that he considered more important, and certainly not on true human relationships, which I later found out it seems to be the main thrust of what he was after.
I read it as a rebellion. I read it as all kinds of things.
Rivera.
You know, I thought, you know, there's, it was no longer important to be anything but today's experience. That's how I felt. I felt it's not important to play the piano. It's not important to go to Yale. It's not important to Yale. It's not important to do anything. You know, he went on a long bike ride, and we didn't even know where he was.
You know, I think that anybody who is 20 is looking for something. I think he was hunting, and he did his bicycle trip, and he came through Vermont, and he loved it.
Coming to Vermont, where there aren't thousands of professional pianists sitting around you, certainly was an easy way to be in a situation where you could develop your own style.
I think Vermont is a very special place for creative people. This is a place where people can totally be themselves in their art. This is one of the reasons why I believe it's such a special place for Michael.
You know, he did find community, and I think he also found a place where he could have an impact.
William Byrd, Galliard number 1. Susan.
Living with a concert pianist is really quite wonderful. Every once in a while, someone will come up to me after a concert and say, "Oh, it must be so wonderful to live with that music all the time." And it is, because I hear how it's put together and I hear how he works on things. When he gives a concert, I'll go and hear it. And in some ways, it'll be the first time I hear everything put together. I'll have been aware of things in the background. I've been aware of phrases and combinations of things that he's worked on and things he's tried. But then I hear it all come together, and in some ways it's very new.
Susan.
As far as music and social activism in Michael's life, there are times when he has to let one dominate over the other. I think that they're both always on his mind.
At a political rally at the State House.
He really has a strong integrity about things. He thinks about them a lot. you're going to be looking at a piece of music and making sure that you interpret it correctly and you're honest about it and you're honest about how you're performing it, you know, it's going to translate to other things in your life about, okay, I've got to be honest about where my food comes from and where my fuel comes from and be honest about what the economic situation is. And I think that that integrity carries through very much as whole cloth for him.
We want to live in peace. Let us live. Let us live. Let us live.
Hard to miss the destruction and the violence in today's world. You pretty much have to be a complete hermit to miss it. So, you know, why stand on the sidelines, but try to be an active participant and influence things as you can here or there. I think it's healthy to keep society changing, hopefully for the better, and to hope each new younger generation will do likewise.
Michael's preparation for concert primarily has to do with the work he does on the music. And that's a very long and arduous process. As for rituals, I think the only things I know of that are ritualistic for him is that he has a tie and a pair of socks that are his lucky tie and his lucky pair of socks. He needs a little time to be quiet before a concert. He also does warm his hands.
Michael immerses his hands in a small metal bowl in a restroom sink.
This helps get the circulation going, get the fingers nice and supple, so in a few moments I'll be out on stage and hands will be ready to play. The piano is an unfortunate instrument in that we can't warm up backstage, generally speaking. If it's nice and pink, that's when I know the water's hot enough. Ready to perform.
Schumann, Davidsbündler, number 17.
Performers in most types of music are playing and performing for maybe 100, 150 people. It's very common size for an audience. You know, as I said, unless you're working in a very specific type of extremely popular music, but most musicians don't. It's fortunate that when I was very young, you know, I was able to perform, you know, 4 or 5 times, you know, per year at these assemblies, they call them, at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. There'd be a big parade of piano students. You would get up, if you were so young, you know, your piece of music was only 20 seconds long. It doesn't matter. Get up on stage, do it, and get used to the idea of communicating. I've met so many musicians over the years that get extremely nervous for performing, and I think they are overly concerned with how they're going to look, you know, how people are going to judge them, and to me, the way that to conquer all that sort of fear and apprehension is, you know, take yourself out of the equation. Just think about the music. Think about the sounds, the purity of the musical ideas and the shapes of the music that the composer wrote and the emotions.
Schumann, Davidsbündler, number 14.
Thank you. first starting to perform piano concerts, I put a fair amount of thought into how to construct a program. You know, 95% of the classical music concerts that you went to, they pretty much slap together pieces in chronological order. And, you know, there were just a lot of formulas that people would fall into for how to put together a program and, you know, put some sort of flashy piece last and get out of there. And that always seemed like, God, I mean, we're all trying to be creative in how we play each piece of music. Why not try to be creative in how we construct our programs for the listener?
Susan.
He's always thought about programming and thought about what would be of interest, what interests him, what'll interest the public. So when he comes up with an idea, first he starts with a really good one, and then he knows how to publicize it and how to pull it together.
Scott Speck.
He embarked on the Beethoven project, in which he plans to play all of the Beethoven sonatas at the age Beethoven was when he wrote them. And I just thought, wow, what an incredible, incredible thing to do.
The first thing I heard him play was Beethoven, and I was very, very impressed with his playing. I remember thinking how extraordinary Michael's interpretation was, how he really got into the music.
Jane Ambrose.
And was doing interpretive things that were very, very special.
The whole project is a bit of a long-range study in psychology and aging development. So I'm going to be developing as a performer, and Beethoven developed as a composer. And then the two processes are intersecting in these live concerts that people get a chance to hear.
Susan.
He will tackle projects with other musicians that really demand a lot of them and of himself, and he'll be tenacious enough to pull it off. The Millennium Festival, which was a four-day festival of the music of the past millennium, involved some 300 musicians, many of whom were recruited from out of state as instrumentalists. It involved probably at least 10 or 15 venues.
Millennium Music Festival was definitely the largest project I've ever done and probably ever will do. The essence of the idea was to present music from the year 1000 to the year 2000 over about 24 concerts and special events. And so I had to research the entirety of the last 1000 years of music and try to come up with representative pieces of music from each historical period.
Jane Ambrose.
The Millennium Festival was just an extraordinary experience. I think all of us met musicians we'd not met before, played with musicians that we'd not played with before. The repertory that I played ranged, for example, from a cantata from the early part of the Baroque period to a piece that was not finished as we were rehearsing it. It was finished one day before we performed the piece. I think that says something about Michael's interests in music.
He's not interested simply in music for his instrument, the piano.
Walter Parker.
He's interested in music. He's interested in things, anything that relates to music as well. And it's perfectly in character for him to put together a festival of 1,000 years of music, 750 of which didn't involve the piano in any way at all, really. So I was impressed by the breadth of his knowledge about music, his thoughtfulness, his intriguing programming, putting things together that have some interesting angle, something that makes them go well together.
Probably the best program I think I ever came up with was a program called 1911 for seven pieces of music that were all composed in a single year. So the idea being like, say you take any moment in time, any moment in any year, you look at the music from that particular year, that would give you a window into the past, you'd be able to, from listening to that music, you'd be able to get some glimmers of the music that led up to it. But equally, that single year, that little snapshot would be a door into the future, too.
Scott Speck.
His relationship to the audience has been very much one of sharing an experience together, rather than I'm going to play for you, you know, but we are sharing. And he gladly will talk to the audience.
At UVM.
My favorite piece on the program by the Russian composer Igor Stravinsky, ballet music, dance music, called Three Scenes from his ballet Petrushka. It takes place at a country fair, sort of a pre-Lent festival in Russia. And the main character, Petrushka, in fact, the three main characters of the ballet are all puppets. The first scene starts with this very invigorating music. I'll play you a little bit of it right now. captures that, you know, what a marionette, you know, has those joints, that rickety nature of the puppet. And, but harmonically, it's just brilliant music. The first chord alone is worth the price of admission. It's got...
The beginning of the 20th century was an amazing time artistically, and not just in music, but in, you know, in painting and literature and, well, even in, you know, psychology and other non-arts-related fields. And that program really gave you a flavor of the time. It showed how the time influenced the composers, and you see the similarities and the differences, how some of the pieces of music were really quite reflecting the romantic music that led up to it. Other pieces of music were very forward-looking and experimental. I love that period and love the music from it.
By 1911, Arno Schoenberg was able to write, as you hear in this piece of music, some really revolutionary music. And to me, it's so interesting that in this time of revolution, time of great social unrest, where people were yelling their opinions at each other at the, you know, at the top of their lungs, that Schoenberg creates his revolutionary piece of music using soft sounds, using silence, using subtlety. And that's what you're going to hear. This is a piece of music that reminds me a lot of Oriental poetry, the sensitivity of Oriental painting. The first piece of the six small piano pieces begins, he instructs me to play it, pianissimo, triple piano, very, very, very soft. And that really sets the tone. Silence, soft sounds are going to predominate in this music. The last piece, the sixth piece in the set, is so miniature. It's like, I mentioned Oriental poetry, so think of a Japanese haiku with only 17 syllables. So this piece of music probably doesn't even have 17 notes in it. The last measure of this last piece in the set, he marks now quadruple, soft, soft, very, 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 very soft, I'm supposed to play it. And over the last two notes, he writes, wie ein Hauch, which is German for like a breath, as if maybe you're not even supposed to hear the actual pitches of the notes, but just some sort of an unconscious musical gesture.
I'm really fascinated by the role of silence in music, the rest, and how they can highlight the notes that are before and after when you're not making a sound. It's really quite a lot to think about.
Rivera.
Last time I heard him play was on my birthday. I had a significant birthday. I turned 60, and they had this fantastic party for me, in which there were more than 200 and something students. I think about 13 of them played, and the idea was that they would play something that they learned while they were with me. And Michael played Opus 19 of Schoenberg, which is one of my favorite pieces in the world, and which I taught him very early. I don't know how. I have no idea how I taught these pieces to him. They're very advanced and very complicated, and a complete new system of notation, and did these beautiful pieces, so beautiful. To his credit, the pieces had grown. And I thought, that's pretty wonderful. Because he did some things that were really different in them, too. The spacing of them was different, I thought. And the silence in the last one, which is in memoriam of Mahler, the last piece, which is about 12 measures or something long, I always felt that I spaced that with a lot of time, but now Michael has taken it further. I mean, he just stayed motionless for about what seemed to be 3 minutes before he just let go. It was wonderful.
One of the really nice things about classical music concerts is that before you begin to play each piece, there's total silence. I love that moment when the audience is waiting. It can be a very nice waiting, just to enjoy the silence, enjoy the anticipation, and then you begin the piece.
Larry Polanski, composer and music professor.
We bring a lot of local musicians to Dartmouth and a lot of non-local musicians to Dartmouth in a kind of an informal music department concert series. And it's a chance for us to hear the people we're interested in and to interact with our colleagues in various ways. I think that particular concert, I was very interested in hearing Michael play the Ligeti Etudes, which are pieces that interest me a lot.
Well, I'm really in love with these etudes or studies that have been written for the piano by Ligeti, who's a Hungarian-born composer. I guess he's living in Germany. I think they're the most, you know, exciting pieces of piano music of the last 50 years, and they're exceedingly difficult, but very viscerally exciting. They have a lot of color, a lot of imagination.
The first one is called Arc-en-Ciel, which means rainbow, though I hear really a whole... maybe a whole sky full of intercrossing rainbows, many different colors. He said that his two favorite jazz pianists were Bill Evans and Thelonious Monk. Interesting choices, and maybe you'll hear some Bill Evans-type harmonies in that first piece.
Ligeti, Arc-en-Ciel.
And the second piece, Fanfares, also has a rather improvisatory element to it in parts that you'll definitely catch on to. It's based on a very simple set of three intervals called horn fifths, and that's the beginning of Beethoven's Farewell Sonata for the piano. It's the beginning of some pieces of music by Johannes Brahms and a lot of German and Austrian composers in it. Even was copped by Americans for the theme music to all the Peanuts television specials, if you ever heard that, and you might remember the theme music to that. So it's in there too, but what Ligeti does in this second piece, the Fanfares, is I think he takes these very pure intervals and he distorts them. It's as if you're looking at them in one of those mirrors at the circus, which makes you impossibly fat or impossibly thin.
Ligeti, Fanfares. Thank you.
A third piece, Blocked Keys, is probably the most unusual piece of piano music I've ever played. It has a very interesting concept, which is that with one hand, I play these very fast, darting lines, chromatic lines that are going up and down and up and down. I'll give you sort of an example of what one of these original lines would be like.
With his right hand.
Something like that. Where in this very same region of the piano that I'm supposed to be playing with one hand, he instructs me to block certain keys with my other hand. And this creates this effect.
Holding his left hand down.
His idea here is essentially, to use a visual arts analogy, negative space or white space. So we have a continuous line, and yet somebody's like taking a scissors and cut out some of the notes. But still, you, in your mind, in your imagination, you fill in the blanks. You connect the dots, as it were, and you can create the continuity that Ligeti is so interesting. So he creates sort of a multicolored line out of silence, which is, I think, really a fantastic idea.
Ligeti, Touche Blanche. Fingers striking the immovable keys.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for setting it up.
Oh, man, pleasure.
Walking down a sidewalk with a white cane.
I have a very severe visual disability, and I've been losing a lot of vision in the last couple of years in particular. The lighting has to be just perfect for me to be able to read music at all, and it takes my eyes longer than normal eyes to adjust to changes in light.
Susan.
One of the things that I learned pretty early on in our relationship was that Michael was losing his vision. I am also legally blind, so this really wasn't a big deal to me. In fact, in some ways, I think it balances the relationship because neither of us is really reliant on the other for transportation or for seeing to function. So I don't know, I think it's part of why we're together. Not a very major part, but somewhat of it. His is changing, mine is not, and I think that there are stresses that go with that for him. I don't know, I guess I've always just sort of figured it was part of who he was.
I basically have two eyesight problems right now. I have night blindness. So when I'm in situations where there's lighting is not bright enough for me, can't see. Very simple. The rods in my eyes just can't pick up the light particles coming in because they're gradually burning out. The other thing is I have tunnel vision. I guess that's the easiest way to talk about it. It's your peripheral vision, and as you get older with this particular eye disease, it gradually narrows. What I see probably with about the same clarity as you or anybody else, just as a narrower field. The Latin name is retinitis pigmentosa. Of course, given that I'm a concert pianist, I'm obviously dealing with backstage areas that are dark, so it's definitely part of the experience. Not too difficult. It's got to get from the backstage to the piano, take a seat, there you are.
A radio broadcast.
The Sleight of Hand Drag by William Albright, played by Vermont pianist Michael Arnewitt, from his classical/jazz album on Musical Heritage Society. You're listening to Vermont Public Radio. I'm Walter Parker.
Scott Speck.
Michael has been interested in jazz for a long time. I know that he came out with, I think it was his first CD, which was classical music that included jazz. For example, the Mio piece, The Creation of the World, it has real jazz in it. He had a piano transcription, I think, that he wrote. And then after these classical interpretations of jazz, he then played some total jazz incredibly well. And I said, wow, is there nothing he can't do?
At the Waitsfield Farmers Market, Zygmunt Romberg, Softly as in a Morning Sunrise.
I think that his decision to play jazz is a really interesting decision, since he doesn't come from that tradition, and that tradition is rife with all kinds of cultural and societal challenges. Here's this Beethoven player who now has decided he's going to play jazz, and I champion and respect greatly someone like him making a decision like that to go against the grain. That is, he's just decided to refashion himself. And it's a good lesson for the rest of us, because we should always be refashioning ourselves.
There was a point 12, 13 years ago where I did start to put the pieces together for how I would play jazz. And then over the last year and a half, I've devoted quite a lot of time each day to it. Still wearing my classical hat too, but really working on the jazz, and it's been a nice new element to my life. Usually when I play classical music, I like to play piano solo by myself, and I found that the jazz playing didn't really take off until I started playing with other people, and maybe because the music isn't written out for you, I find that jazz musicians actually listen to each other better than classical musicians do.
People he plays with are quite wonderful, and I think that that's a good thing. I think it's something that he is happier doing with other people than doing solo, and I think that being a concert pianist and just being a concert pianist can be fairly isolating. So I think that it feeds a really different part of him to do the jazz.
People sitting on the lawn. Small children dancing.
Certainly the jazz musician deals with rhythmic precisions that are really incredibly minute, much more sophisticated than classical music rhythms, and something that I wasn't really trained to have a good ear for. Probably swings back on my classical playing and helps that out as well.
Anthony Santor, bass player.
Well, his musical vision is huge. It's infinite, from what I can see. His sight, the only thing for me, the first time I hung out with him when we went to a performance in Burlington, we were walking, and he had his cane, and I said to him, I've never, you know, been around someone that's sight-challenged like this, so what do I need to do? And he told me, if you see me walking into a pole, grab me.
Brad Meldow, quit.
When playing with Michael, you definitely immediately hear the technical side of him. You know, there isn't a thing that really, I think, if he can hear it, he can play it, because he has perfect pitch. And he listens beautifully, and it's a listening music.
Experiences with improvising, and definitely enjoyed it. When I was a kid, I would improvise classical music. Jazz, in many ways, is composing without rewrites. Your improvising is a form of composition, the most spontaneous form there is, I guess.
Performing is that way too. There's no take two with performing. You're ephemeral. You perform before an audience and it's gone. You can't redo it, because that's part of the beauty of it, is that it does disappear into the air.
William Mayer, Fantasia.
One of the great things about my first teacher was that he had no prejudice against contemporary music and new music that's being composed today. A couple of years after starting to play some contemporary music with him, I started taking some composition classes. In fact, some of the music schools I went to in the summer, I studied as much composition as I did piano.
He plays like a composer. Michael doesn't play pretty tunes. I mean, he plays the music, you know, everything that's in it. So it's not just about the melody. And he has something wonderful and original to say musically.
Dennis Bathory-Kitts, composer.
In preparation for a concert that would eventually appear in Europe, Michael created a very imaginative program called American Kaleidoscope, which included brand new pieces, pieces written for this concert, including one by me and one by David Gunn and many other composers, and American masters from the 20th century. That dovetailed very nicely into a program that I was trying to set up with André Posman at the Rotopompe in Ghent. I worked out some things with André and put Michael in touch, and then they worked out the details of the program, and suddenly we had a bridge that was being constructed between the two countries across the ocean.
Michael at a train station. Alan Sean, Boogie Woogie.
There's an outfit in Ghent, Belgium called the Rotopompe, and they do exchanges with other countries or parts of other countries.
On the train, Michael's fingers rehearse on the tray table.
They've met some composers here and made some friendships, and so they want to have a festival a year from now, actually, of music from Vermont. In particular, they thought they would sort of preface it by having me come over this year and give a program of that would feature Vermont music but would be more general and have a little bit of a preview for the three-day festival.
The train reaches the town. Michael walks out from a hotel to a residential street where a man comes out to meet him.
Hi, Andre. Morning.
The door is already open.
Oh, it's already open. Okay.
Okay.
Come. Bye. I think I selected a pretty representative sampling of different types of American music. There's so many composers nowadays that people pretty well figured out that there is not like one tradition like there was in Mozart's time or even during the Romantic period, but now, so many different types of music are being written and explored and developed. There are like 15 composers on tonight's program, so it's a real kaleidoscope.
Michael takes a bow. André Posman, director, New Music Center, Ghent, Belgium.
This is the first concert I do with Americans, and I'm very curious to hear the music from over there. Since 10 years, 15 years, there are composers who really make beautiful things, accessible things, new and fresh, but without aggression.
Eric Lyon, Sandoz. Dennis Bathory-Kitts, Prelude number 20 from Turquoise Stray. George Crumb, Spiral Galaxy. The sheet music is printed along a spiral on the page. Eve Bugalarian, Fireside.
When I sit by the side of the blazing fire on a cold December night and gaze at the rolling and rollicking flames as they cast their flickering light, I see what I would be in future years.
David Fuqua. Once again, once again. I am for you. A star. Afterwards, talking with members of the audience.
It has a beautiful atmosphere, I think. I don't know how you say that in English.
That's right.
The sphere was good in special color also. I think you have used different colors in your playing.
Yes, it's really good. I like really your anthem.
The way
your interpretation, the way you play.
Probably discussing CDs.
5 or 6 years ago, there was a pretty marked change. Some listeners
in a restaurant.
Be able to get out of the piano.
On the train.
I'm sure there will be another point, some point in the future, where that might happen again.
Walking down the street towards the concert venue. Walter Parker.
The thing about Michael is, his programming, his playing, everything is informed by this great intelligence. I think of Michael as not so much a pianist, but as a fine musician who plays the piano, but whose interest really extends far beyond the 88 keys of the piano in the world of music, and far beyond just music that is written for the piano.
Scott Speck.
Certainly when I first heard him play, it went beyond anything I had ever heard live. A level of both musical depth and intellectual acuity that was so clearly part of his playing, that he was intimately aware of the importance to the structure of every note that he played. And of course, last but not least, the technical facility was incredible.
Sometimes it's hard to look at Michael when he plays.
Jane Ambrose.
Because he's so emotional in his commitment to the music that you can see it in his mouth and you can see it in his eyes and in his eyebrows and even in his quite confined body movements that he almost has to restrain himself when he's playing.
He's all about the music.
Anthony Santor.
If he's not practicing, he's performing. If he's not performing, he's taking, he's transcribing off of CDs. So he's really just all about music.
He is lost somewhere in the music when he plays. And that is
Sandy Morningstar.
Amazing to me that he is able to make that kind of connection with his own inner creative angels, or however you wish to describe that. He's perfectly calm. He's so centered in the sound that he's producing.
Susan.
I think that he sees that he has to be involved in the music on a lot of different levels. to do it well. He has to be involved in it emotionally. He has to be involved in it technically. He has to be involved in it intellectually. He has to put it in a social context. He needs to know who wrote it and when and what was going on at the time. I mean, it is an immersion. And in that sense, I think it is a very spiritual thing.
Michael
Rivera.
Talent is extraordinary. It certainly surpasses anything that I could hope for as a performer myself. I think he's way above the teacher.
Brahms, Intermezzo, Opus 118, Number 2. playing in an empty auditorium. Credits. Pianist Michael Arnowitt. Producer and director Susan Bettman. Director of photography and associate producer Jeff Farber. Cameras Jeff Farber, Lasse Toft, Nora Jacobson, Susan Bettman. Jib operator Bob Rickner. Editors Jeff Farber, Susan Bettman. Editorial consulting Dorothy Todd, Deb Ellis, Eugene Jaretke, Nora Jacobson. Music editing Michael Arnowitt, Jeff Brumbaugh. Sound mix engineering, Peter Wilder. Sound re-recording, Susan Bettman, Dennis Dara, Dennis Bathory-Kitts. Title design, Leah Rosendahl, Jaguar Design. Production assistants, Sandra Betchelder, Sophie Bettman-Kerson, Peter Bettman-Kerson, Barbara Buckley, Gaia Fried, Olivia Gay, Paul Gruler, Manuela Hartzeuker, Amsterdam, Josh Kerson, Sandra Laurie, Henrietta Jordan, Gary Miller. Production equipment, Nora Jacobson, Off the Grid Productions, Ed Dooley, Mad River Media, Marlborough College, Holkamp Media Amsterdam, Play It Again Sam. Public relations, Beth Burgess. Duplication services, Videosyncrasies. Transcription, Willow Hecht, Cheryl Peterson, Britta Chernock, Terry Webster. Musicians, Elaine Russell, Anthony Santor, Steve Wienert, Brianna Wood Dunbar. Narrator, Nessa Rabin. Poet at Peace Rally, David Budbill. Piano technicians, Dale Howe, Joost van Hartveld. Page turners, Susan Arnowitt-Reed, Elisa Medinilla, Ellen Lampo. Bicyclist, Josh Hansen. Still and archival photographs, the Arnowitt family, Roger Ide, Todd Lassard, Jenna Saleo, Paul Cortese, Nick Wheeler, Michael Marslint, Jeb Wallace Brodeur, Times Argus. Film excerpt, Brother Bread, Sister Puppet, a film by Jeff Farber, used by permission of the producer. Locations in Vermont, Chandler Music Hall, Flynn Space, Mailboxes, etc., Susan's Kitchen, Musée Mimi, Unitarian Church of Montpelier, Vermont Public Radio, Colchester, Waitsfield Farmers Market, Wood Art Gallery, University of Vermont Recital Hall. In New Hampshire, Faulkner Recital Hall, Dartmouth College. In Europe, Rode Pomp, New Music Center, Ghent, Belgium. Bethanien Klooster, Amsterdam. Centrum Nieuwe Muziek, Middelburg, the Netherlands. Special thanks, Rick Winston and Andrea Sirota, the Savoy Theater. Produced by the Battle of White Plains Theater Company. Copyright 2004, North Middlesex, Vermont. Visit our website at www.battleofwhiteplainstheater.org. Audio description by Lou Lasher.